Hi, everyone. Today, we'll be taking a quick deep dive into history and nutrition and how seed oils were foisted into our diets. Listening to today's guest, ophthalmologist and scientific researcher, Dr. Chris Kenobi, will give us all some food for thought, and I'm thinking it will prove to be a healthier intake than those oils we'll be speaking about. His book is The Ancestral Diet. I'm Robin, and this is Tributaries. Chris, how did you get pulled off the path of surgeon to becoming one of the world's leading authorities on vegetable oils?
Well, first, thanks, Robin, for having me on. It's really an honor and a pleasure. I really got into nutrition research out of my own suffering. And that, for me, started with arthritis about 30 years ago. And I made some changes in my diet back in 2011 that were towards paleo. And with that, I had this huge improvement in my arthritis. It was staggering to me after I'd suffered for 17 years or so. And so life-changing to me that I started to learn about the paleo diet. And I read Lauren Cordain's book, The Paleo Answer. And I was shocked and astounded that diet had so much power to not only prevent disease, but also to reverse disease. And I never learned this in medical school. Some of the things of Lauren Cordain's work didn't sit well with me. It didn't make sense to me. And I finally came across the work of Weston A. Price in 2013. And Weston Price was a researcher that in the 1930s evaluated populations all around the world as they were transitioning from their native traditional diets to westernized diets, meaning they were consuming processed foods. And what he discovered was that these people on their native traditional diets were extraordinarily healthy and free of chronic disease, again, as long as they remained on their traditional diets. But when they began to consume what he called the displacing foods of modern commerce, you can just translate that to processed foods, they began to develop chronic disease, degenerative diseases, he called them. And these foods, Price called those refined flours, refined sugars, canned goods, sweets, confectionery, and vegetable fats, he called them. We call these vegetable oils, but in those days, they often referred to them as vegetable fats. So that resonated with me, and that actually has guided my work ever since. So for more than a decade, that work of Weston Price has guided my work. I eventually hypothesized that processed foods might be driving age-related macular degeneration. I'm an ophthalmologist and eye surgeon, and I worked on that and eventually left practice to pursue that full-time, published a paper, published a book on that, started a nonprofit foundation. But the thing that kept coming back to me, Robin, was as I moved forward, was that more and more I saw that the vegetable oils were the component of processed foods that seemed to be so strongly connected to development of obesity and chronic disease, like coronary heart disease, strokes, cancers, diabetes, metabolic disease, and so on. And very, very few people were talking about that. I went public with that in 2019, and that's where my work has been focused ever since. So for 5, 6, 7 years maybe, I've focused greatly on processed foods and particularly vegetable oils as drivers of obesity and chronic disease.
Yes, and this topic is currently so important. So let me first thank you for writing The Ancestral Diet Revolution, and then encourage our listeners to buy a couple of copies, one to read and others to share. This introduction of vegetable oils into the human diet is translating into a perfect storm for overall ill health and, as you put it, the perfect recipe for obesity, diabetes, and metabolic disaster. Are we talking about all oils other than meat and animal-based fats? Does it include seed oils and nut oils and all of the above? And do we move right into omega-6s and 3s right now?
Yes, that's a great question, Robin. We do need to categorize the vegetable oils because they're not all bad. I would categorize these into, first, the seed oils, or what we might ought to call the industrial seed oils, and these are the really dangerous ones. These oils would be the oils of soybean, corn, canola, cottonseed, rapeseed, grapeseed, sunflower, safflower, rice bran. Now, that list right there is my worst of the worst. And then kind of falling more favorable than those, but still not favorable, would be sesame oil and peanut oil used in some of the traditional Asian cooking. So they have a much better track record. But those are essentially the seed oils. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that are really dangerous. Now that you have the fruit oils, and that's mostly olive oil and avocado oil, and those are much safer, still I wouldn't recommend necessarily. We can dig into that detail later. Then you have the safest group of all, and that is the tropical oils, palm kernel, and coconut oils. Two of those are really safe. That would be coconut and palm kernel because they're 2% omega-6 linoleic acid, and we'll have to come back to that. And palm oil is 10% omega-6 linoleic acid, but there's really only two oils that I would recommend that people consume regularly, and that's coconut and palm kernel because they're really low in omega-6 and they require no industrial processing. So they're very, very low in these advanced lipid oxidation end products. I hope that kind of categorizes them.
Absolutely,
so, yeah.
Yes,
so it's the industrial seed oils that are by far and away the most dangerous. They occupy about 89% of the oils consumed in the United States. The other 11% is made up of all those others. So people always, they love to talk about olive oil. But olive oil is 2% of American consumption. 2%. And globally, it's only about 1%. And so there's, just trifling small amounts of olive oil in the food supply, really.
And a lot of it, I've been reading, is labeled olive oil and is not really olive oil. Apparently, the drug dealers were getting away from drugs and dealing in fake olive oil because it was safer as far as the risk to them was concerned.
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about the omega-6, and that is known as LA, linoleic acid. Mm-hmm. So for everyone listening, we may use LA or we may use omega-6, but please know we're speaking about the same thing.
Right, right.
You write that high linoleic acid, those omega-6s, induce chronic disease in four ways. When we're concerning oxidation and inflammation, which are two of those ways you write about, is oxidation driving inflammation?
Yes. Yeah, so there are four main pillars of hazard, I call them, that the high omega-6 diets, which are coming almost exclusively from seed oils, how they're connected to overweight, obesity, and chronic disease. And those four pillars of hazard are oxidation, inflammation, toxicity, direct toxicity, and nutrient deficiency. So you put those four together, this is the perfect recipe for metabolic disaster and physical degeneration. So out of the four of those, the oxidation is by far and away the most dangerous, because oxidation is like we're rusting inside. So when you consume lots of seed oils, and we should at some point, Robin, get into the history of the seed oils and how they've increased over time and how that correlates with all this disease. But when you consume large amounts of seed oils, you're consuming lots of omega-6 linoleic acid, or LA, like you said, and that accumulates in your body. It accumulates in your body fat, in your cell membranes, and in your inner mitochondrial membranes. It becomes pro-oxidative and pro-inflammatory and toxic. The reason that it's oxidative is because of the double bonds in the omega-6 fats. For example, saturated fats have no double bond. They're fully saturated. And the omega-6s have two or more double bonds. And these double bonds are subject to oxidative attack by free radicals. And we make gazillions of free radicals every day, just naturally. It's just part of our biology. It's part of metabolism. So what happens is ultimately when they accumulate in your body, essentially, they drive this oxidation, and this oxidation ultimately damages the mitochondria, the powerhouses of the cell that create our energy. So we have energy failure at the cellular level, and that then leads to sickened cells that become insulin resistant, and they spew out at the same time more free radicals, which causes inflammation or contributes to inflammation. Then omega-6s then also, they are the precursor to inflammatory molecules. So the omega-6 linoleic acid is converted into arachidonic acid. It's an 18-carbon to a 20-carbon conversion. And then arachidonic acid gives rise to inflammatory prostaglandins, leukotrienes, eicosanoids, and so on that are inflammatory. Then the third component, this third pillar, is the toxicity. So the high omega-6, again, as that linoleic acid is metabolized into downstream metabolic products, it creates products like 4-hydroxynonenal, 4-HNE, malondialdehyde, carboxyethylpyrrole, acrolein.
Alcohols and...
Yes, all these aldehydes that are collectively cytotoxic, genotoxic, mutagenic, carcinogenic, atherogenic, thrombogenic, meaning they create clots, obesogenic and diabeticgenic. It just really couldn't get any worse.
Yes, and as I read in your book, there's just a threshold where you don't need very much of an overdose, so to speak, of these omega-6 to start really creating havoc and a real strong toxicity in the body, whereas sugar, which we'll talk about in a little bit, you need high doses of sugar to start wreaking havoc in the body. And so I think that's a key point.
Right. Yeah, you said it well, that it doesn't take a lot. I've looked a lot at ancestrally living populations, and these are populations that have no processed foods. There's many of them historically, not very many left today, but these populations all have an omega-6 linoleic acid consumption of less than about 2% of their total calories. Now, this is where Americans were back in 1865, before we had any seed oils in our diet whatsoever. We consumed about 1.1% of our calories, because we've modeled a typical American diet in 1865, again, before we had any vegetable oils, and 1.1% of our calories were omega-6 linoleic acid. So that doubled by 1909. We'll just jump to the end. By 2010, omega-6 linoleic acid had increased to 11.8% of our diet. So it increased 1,000% or 11-fold. And with that came the obesity, the coronary heart disease, the cancer, diabetes. And if you want, I can go through some of that. But that's basically what's happened to us in terms of omega-6.
Right. And one thing to bring up, I think, somewhere, and we may as well bring it up now, is that omega-6 is an essential fatty acid. We need that in our bodies, but we actually can get enough through our food. So adding all this extra is not only unnecessary, but obviously toxic, as you're bringing up. And also, you wanted to share a little bit about the history and why we all of a sudden were eating all of this. It was all part of the industrial age. Unfortunately, it's part and parcel with that, along with the pharmaceutical industry, as well as Big Pharma's presence on all of the farms.
Right, right. Up until 1865, the world had almost no vegetable oils at all. Now, there was some production and consumption of olive oil going back thousands of years, tiny, tiny amounts of coconut oil, sesame oil, a couple of others. But up through 1865, we've looked at all the evidence, and this is a pending publication. The evidence suggests that the average person in the world consumed less than 0.1 grams of seed oils per person per day in 1865. This is global. It was the same or less in the United States. We had virtually none. All we would have had was tiny, tiny amounts of olive oil. Almost nobody would have had it up through 1865 or even 1900 in the U.S. And then cottonseed oil was introduced right after the American Civil War, about 1866. Americans didn't want it because they knew that it was lubricating oil. It was machine oil, and it was lamp oil, and then it was used for fertilizer. I mean, they didn't want anything to do with it. Almost be like, you know, telling us to consume motor oil today. But that didn't deter the manufacturers because they knew there was money to be had. So the first thing that they did was formulate margarine. They called it oleomargarine. That was a mixture of coconut oil and butter. And they sold it as oleomargarine, which eventually became margarine. The second thing they did was they began to adulterate olive oil in the 1870s with cottonseed oil. And we were consuming very significant amounts of that. I mean, it was very low on a national level. For example, we shipped 55,000 barrels of so-called olive oil to France, and they made complaint in 1880, and they stopped importing from the United States. So then by 1911, Procter & Gamble then made Crisco, which is loaded with trans fat. It was originally cottonseed oil that was partially hydrogenated.
Which is an industrial process.
An industrial process, yes, to create this semi-solid. This looked kind of like lard, and that's what they sold it at, was essentially a replacement for lard and beef tallow. So we had margarine replacing butter, mostly, and Crisco replacing lard and beef tallow. And this is what the industry did. There was lots of money to be had. And so they gradually got these oils into the food supply. And eventually then people started consuming just the oils themselves more so. So we went from basically at 0 grams per person per day in 1865 of any oil. 90 to 95% of the population would have had no oils whatsoever. If they used a cooking fat, it would have been butter, lard, or beef tallow. That's it. That's all they had. Rare people had olive oil. 1900, we were about 1 gram per person per day. 1909, we're at 9 grams per person per day. 1960, we're at 19 grams per person per day. And at 2010, 80 grams per person per day. 80 grams of fat, it's 9 calories per gram, is 720 calories. 720 calories in 2010, that's 32% of U.S. caloric intake. Now, there's a little bit of loss there from plate losses, but we're at least a fourth to a third, and some people, more than a third of their diet is made up of seed oils. And these people, generally speaking, are not adding any oil to their food. They're getting it all from processed foods, from foods already packaged, prepared, restaurant foods, and fast foods. Because if it has an oil in it, it's loaded. It's going to be a vegetable oil. Look at any package, any box, any preparation, any canned good. If there's oil in it, it's almost always going to be one of these vegetable oils. In the United States, it's mostly soybean and canola.
Right. Go to Whole Foods. They use canola oil in all their baked goods.
They do.
Hello? What is... I don't know. I can't even say what it is because it just blows my mind that it's even happening. And it's important and interesting that one of the things that these oils are lacking, you're not really getting anything from them. Whereas when you do have lard or tallow, you're getting vitamins
yes.
and minerals. So you're not only getting too much omega-6, you're not getting anything that the body is really craving and wanting. And then hence you think you're hungry and you're not hungry, really. You just want nutrition.
Right. That's the fourth pillar of hazard, I call it. Is that the oils, all the oils, even the good ones like coconut oil, palm kernel oil, and good quality authentic olive oil, they have no vitamins A, D, or K2, which you will get in substantial amounts in butter and in tallow and in much lower amounts in lard, so pork fat.
But, and milk and eggs as well, right?
Oh, yeah, and milk and eggs. Yeah, absolutely. Excellent source of those fat-soluble vitamins A, D, and K2.
You can just see the writing on the wall from the last 10 minutes of what you've been talking about. And the idea for so long now is that sugar has been blamed for so many things, especially diabetes, of course. And it reminded me of a study I saw 20 and 30 years ago. I think his name was Dr. Bradley. There was a whole thing going on with women that were getting all of these breast implants. And they were all of a sudden feeling ill, and they thought, oh, they're leaking, so we need to take them out, and blah, blah, blah. But it was a long time before someone looked at the demographic of these women. They were drinking lots of diet sodas.
Mm.
So that was a huge part of the problem as well. So in saying that, Japan and Okinawa have become the poster child for the research. And maybe you can just dive in a little bit to that.
Yes. I'd like to mention the American data first, if that's okay with you, Robin. In America, for example, obesity, a lot of people don't know this, but obesity in the late 19th century, from about 1870s to 1900, was 1.2% in American men age 18 to 80, 1.2%. And obesity then increased to about 13.4% by 1960. I think it was 23% in 1988, 30.5% in 1999, and 42.5% by 2018. So obesity increased 35-fold between 1900 and 2018. That's a 3,400% increase. Let me mention diabetes as well, because these two kind of run together for similar reasons. Sir William Osler, the most famed physician in the last 200 years, published his first textbook, Principles and Practice of Medicine, I think it's what it's called, in 1892. And in that book, he noted what the prevalence of diabetes was in 1890 from the U.S. Census. And it was 0.0028%. That's about 1 in 36,000 people. All right, that is staggering low by today's standards. So by 1935, diabetes had increased to 0.37%, which still is really small compared to today, but it was up 132-fold from 1890. So this trend continued. By about 1989 or 90, diabetes was about 3%. Fast forward to 2016, we're at 13% diabetes prevalence in the U.S. So we went from 0.0028% to 13%. That's a 4,643-fold increase in diabetes. If it had doubled, that would be statistically significant. So that's what happened in the U.S., just with the obesity and diabetes, and we could talk, if we had time, more about heart disease and cancer and all this, which have gone up similarly. But if we look at sugar consumption, from 1822 to 2018 did increase from about, I think it was around 40 calories per day up to around, by 2018, to around 520 calories per day. But what people don't realize is that sugar mostly increased up until about 1922, and then it just was almost flat between 1922 and 1987. Then it went up again after we went lower fat diets. So it increased again until 1999, and it's been falling. The vegetable oils have been increasing all along. So if we just look at this period between 1922 and 1987, this is what's really interesting to me, is that sugar barely changed. It was 473 calories per person per day in 1922, 497 calories in 1987. It's up 5%. Vegetable oils during that period increased from 78 calories to 550 calories. Same period. All right. Obesity climbed from 2.95% in 1922 to 18.6%. So let me break this down. During this period, 1922 to 1987, sugar increased 5%. Vegetable oils increased 605%, and obesity increased 532%. So you tell me, if you're a sugar theorist and you believe sugar is the cause of obesity and diabetes and all this other, then explain that. There's so much more. This is just, we're barely getting started.
Yes.
Right? I can do this with five nations right now. And a lot of the data applies to the whole world. It's similar to the whole world. We have very little change in sugar, while we see obesity and diabetes and cancer, coronary heart disease, all going through the roof, right? You need correlation in order to prove causation. If you don't have correlation, you're going to have an extreme uphill battle to try
thank
to prove.
Thank you. Yes, thank you for saying
causation.
That. Yeah, and the interesting thing that all of this was just making me think about was the processing of all the oils. You know, thinking about correlation, causation, if you wanted to play devil's advocate, for instance, and just go, well, the whole world is more toxic now. And so I started feeling like, I wonder how much of that toxicity is related to the industrializing of these oils and the whole process of farming them and the way they farm these days and producing them. If all of it went away, it would be quite a different place overall. You know, we'd have different lives for sure. And carbs have also become villainized. And I'm wondering how you look at the overall relationship of carbs to sugar to vegetable oils in correlation to ill health.
I'm glad you brought that up, Robin, because, again, for those who vilify carbohydrates in general, well, between 1909 and 2010, a period of 101 years, carbohydrates actually decreased by 5 grams per day. I think it was 495 grams down to 490. Carbohydrates, they had a downward trend up until the 1980s, and then carbs went up in the 1980s to 1997, and then carbs have been going down again ever since 1997. If you look between 1909 and 2013, at least, if not 2018, carbohydrates have been mostly on the decline. And again, only two periods from about 1980 to 1997 where the carbs were going up. The only time you see the correlation with the carbohydrate increase was from, again, about 1980 to 1997. All the rest of the time, we have no correlation.
Yes, and the oils keep on proving
themselves.
The oils
keep increasing. That's the one thing that has increased at least through 2010. It's been pretty stable since 2010 in the United States. But globally, the vegetable oils keep increasing almost in every country in the world, almost everyone.
And vitamin and mineral needs increase in direct proportion to these high numbers of vegetable oils and the omega-6 and, of course, the processed foods. Can you give us some of the reasoning why that is going on?
Well, that's going to be a tough one for me to answer, Robin, but I would say that in general, when you have increasing seed oil consumption, again, you're setting yourself up for a pro-oxidative and pro-inflammatory environment.
Right, I guess that answers it.
Yeah, and the way to defeat that, you're absolutely correct, is that you need very sufficient, if not excess, vitamins and minerals, because that is going to help you to minimize the oxidation, the inflammation, the toxicity of those oils.
Right.
And what we're doing instead is we're consuming more and more processed foods. I don't think processed food consumption has ever stopped increasing, which means that, just as you mentioned, we're getting fewer vitamins and minerals. And you cannot fix this. I don't have all the answers as to why, but you cannot fix this with supplementing vitamins and minerals. It just doesn't work.
Right.
There is
so
almost trivial evidence that supplementing vitamins and minerals is beneficial. That's a very, very, very complicated issue, and I don't fully understand why it doesn't work. But suffice it to say, with the minerals, absorption's very, very poor.
Yes.
And when you take minerals in an inorganic form, so when you take them in an organic form, which means in food, you can absorb those.
Right. It's so funny, throughout your book, you go, well, if you're eating food, it's just like, isn't that what we're all eating? And then you don't need to look any further to say, oh, well, no, most people are not eating food. And so it's also interesting, you know, you spoke about the coconut oil, certainly has been a mainstay in tropical places. And no, there is no AD and K2 in the oil, but what else are these people eating? They're eating fish, which is providing those nutrients for them and providing good oils as well. You know, at this point in the interview, I thought, I just want to go up to the rooftops and start screaming, vegetable oils are in infant formulas. Please, can we wake up there? It's a toxic situation that accumulates and accumulates and accumulates.
Absolutely. Sally Fallon Morrell of the Weston A. Price Foundation.
A guest many times on Tributaries.
Oh, good. Yeah. Many years ago, I heard her say that infant formulas are the most processed foods on the planet. And I think she's right. All they are is pretty much vegetable oils, refined flours, and sugar. That's what makes up processed food.
Right.
That's what processed food really is. It's refined flours, refined sugars, vegetable oils, and trans fats. Without vegetable oils, you can't make trans fats, essentially. You can make them in incredibly small amounts.
Right.
But that's where they're coming from. So then they're just putting in, just adding in, again, synthetic vitamins to those infant formulas. Disastrous.
Right.
And we wonder why infants are obese, little children are becoming diabetic, why the cancer rate continues to increase in children. We just need to wake up and open our eyes to this.
And change our habits. Where are some other places that these omega-6s are hidden? One place is if you buy meat, unfortunately, that's fed corn, GMO corn, to fatten them up before they're slaughtered. So what do we do with this accumulated toxicity? Obviously, okay, we've learned, let's cut out the oils as much as possible, cut out the processed food. But is there a way to go deeper as far as ridding ourselves of this overt toxicity that's just accumulated? Saunas, herbs, I don't know. What do you have to say?
Yes, great question, Robin. So there's really three main ways to first get your omega-6 down to an what I would call an ancestral level, which means that, again, it should be less than 2% of your calories. And that's about 5 grams of omega-6 linoleic acid per day. So the first thing is you've got to get rid of all of these seed oils first. And it's not nearly as hard as people think, but you need to prepare your own food or be very cautious when you're buying food or buying restaurant or fast food. It's incredibly, you know, difficult
Forget
to get
it.
Away from
yeah.
those. Yeah. So that's number one. Number two is that, just as you said, the animals, okay, to qualify this, the monogastric animals that are fed corn and soy, which would be the primary animals that we eat that are monogastric, would be pigs and chicken. And but monogastric animals cannot convert omega-6s into saturated and monounsaturated fats like cattle can. So if chicken and pigs are fed GMO, or it doesn't have to be GMO, but if they're typically fed GMO corn and soy,
right.
that's high in omega-6, and they will accumulate very high omega-6 in their body fat, like 20%+, just like people. So then we eat that, and that's similar in omega-6 to canola oil, which is about 20%. If you're consuming butter, lard, or beef tallow that's all naturally raised, it will be around 1.5% to maybe 3%
Brilliant.
Maximum omega-6 linoleic acid. Now, when you're consuming beef, it doesn't hardly even matter if it's 100% grass-fed or if it's corn and soy-fed, because cattle, ruminants, they're the herbivores, they have a multi-compartment stomach system.
Right.
With one of those stomachs is a fermentation, or what I call biohydrogenation chamber. It can hydrogenate the omega-6s into saturated into monounsaturated fats. I would fully recommend trying to get 100% grass-fed beef if you can, because it's so much safer. You avoid the GMO situation and glyphosate poison, right? Or mostly avoid it. But 100% grass-fed cow in its fat will have about 1.5% to maybe 2.5% omega-6 linoleic acid. A cow that's finished on corn and soy will only be around 2.5% to 3.5%, maybe 4%.
You're right. So
omega-6
it's not that
linoleic
much different.
Acid. Not that much different. So the healthiest thing that you could eat at McDonald's would be the hamburger patty, in my view. That's the healthiest thing they have there. And then there's the third thing you can do to get your omega-6 down, and that's to mostly get nuts and seeds out of your diet. So nuts and nut oils, of course, they're all high in omega-6 with the exception of macadamia nuts, which are 2% omega-6 linoleic acid. So that's the only nut that's
interesting,
low.
Right? Going back to the tropics again.
Yeah, exactly. So we have very high, in general, Americans and most of the westernized world has very high omega-6 linoleic acid in our body fat. It averaged about 14.5% globally in recent decades, the last two decades, but it was 21.5% in Americans in 2008. It should be under 4%.
So two questions about the seeds and the nuts. Does sprouting them make a difference in that rate of omega-6? And does eating organic make a difference? Probably wouldn't be.
So the sprouting wouldn't change the content of the oil.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly, absolutely, 100% nuts and seeds and the oils of those that are not processed, that's going to be tremendously healthier than seed oils. But nevertheless, when you consume high omega-6, it's going to accumulate in your body. And in your body, you will metabolically convert the omega-6 linoleic acid into those toxic advanced lipid oxidation end products, 4-H&E, malondialdehyde, and so on. If you want to get really healthy, you need to avoid the oils and the high omega-6 foods.
Let me bring you back to the research. You've admitted, I think it was in your book, that you're a total research geek at this point.
Yeah,
and everything in your book is proving that point here. But in looking at a lot of the research, what oils were they using? Were they using just run-of-the-mill safflower oils? Were they looking at organic or cold-pressed oils? Does any of that flavor into the research and or how good or bad they are?
You mean just the research in general? What kind of oils are they using, you mean?
Yeah. Do they ever bother making a comparison between a non-GMO and a GMO or an organic versus a non-organic? Or really, it wouldn't play that much into it?
I think there's been precious little comparison between oils in the research. And the reason, Robin, is because in general, over the past six decades, we've been told that vegetable oils, seed oils, are good. We've been told they're heart healthy.
Right, you know, hence the soy industry, right?
Yeah,
I mean, the soy industry bad-mouthed coconut oil and palm oil, and everything shifted somewhere between 30 and 50 years, probably.
Oh, absolutely, because beginning in the 1950s, there was a collective vilification of saturated fat.
Right.
And so we were told meat is bad, animal fats are bad, and seed oils are good. And for only one reason, because they lower your cholesterol. And indeed they do. And I always say, so does arsenic. Arsenic will lower your cholesterol for the exact same
good
reason.
Good comeback, Chris.
Yeah, it's the exact same reason that seed oils do, because they're both highly pro-oxidative. Arsenic kills you through oxidation. Seed oils kill you mostly through oxidation.
Yeah.
They both do the same thing. And so that's why they lower your LDL cholesterol, because the LDL cholesterol then becomes oxidized. When it's loaded with the seed oils, it becomes oxidized, and then it's pulled out of the circulation and implanted into your arteries,
creating inflammation
and atherosclerotic plaques.
Crazy.
Yes. So that's why your cholesterol goes lower when you're consuming seed oils. It doesn't help you at all. You're killing yourself as you lower your cholesterol a little bit.
Yeah. Well, Chris, tell us about your foundations.
There's two foundations, Cure AMD Foundation, and that relates to age-related macular degeneration. And there's also the newer one, Ancestral Health Foundation. And this one relates essentially to everything we're talking about, natural foods and health or processed foods versus chronic disease. These are both fully IRS-recognized 501c3 organizations. We are supported by philanthropic donations, and we want to do global research to try to bring this evidence to light. I do also have a website that's chriskenobi.com. That's C-H-R-I-S. Kenobi is K-N-O-B-B-E.com.
This is a whole other potential two-hour interview, but just let me ask you briefly, what are you discovering about the macular degeneration? Diet-related, yes. Have you seen reversals?
Well, first, I would say that without processed foods, I think it's almost impossible to produce macular degeneration, like most of these other conditions. It's just almost impossible. Hundreds of people have reported back to me since I went public with this back in 2016 that their macular degeneration has almost entirely stabilized. Oh my God, almost every single one of them have reported to me their macular degeneration has stabilized. Some have had some reversal, some improvement. Some of them have better vision. Only one or two have had some progression. And so it does take time and a lot of effort, and you got to you have to be very careful with your diet when you already have these kinds of diseases like age-related macular degeneration, AMD. But you need to get back to an ancestral diet, which is exactly what we're talking about. Right. Get rid of the seed oils, the refined flours, the added sugars even. That's not helping you. And get to a natural, completely natural diet.
Right. Well, Chris, is there anything that's glaringly missing from what we've been talking about today? Is there a point that you feel like you really need to make? Other than get this book, people, it's a great read. And honestly, I hope it becomes mandatory reading for any medical student.
Yeah, I would love to ask your listeners and viewers to read this new book. It's called The Ancestral Diet Revolution. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, essentially wherever books are sold online. It won't be in bookstores. And possibly I'd love for people to leave us a review on Amazon, because that helps spread the message.
Right.
And I don't accept any compensation for any of the work that I do in this field. I left practice 9 years ago, and I'll never look back. We want to reach billions with this message, and it's catching on.
Even though these days we have thousands of health and fitness experts telling us what we need to do, I think you were very wise to quote Jack LaLanne, "If man made it, don't eat it."
Yes. I love that quote, and I love Jack LaLanne.
He's the man.
He was not a scientist, but boy, did he bring a great message to us, right?
Great information as we all move forward, don't you think? Dr. Chris Kenobi. For anything tributaries related, we can be found at tributariesradio.wordpress.com, and our podcasts are where you'll hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.